Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 26th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us is WCAI lead reporter Sarah Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Sarah, let's start with the news this week that Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station will be relocating its spent fuel rods on site. Explain what the fuel rods are and what this means.
Sure. So fuel rods are essentially, they're the part of the nuclear reactor that keep it going. They're thin metal rods. They're filled with uranium, and they're switched out at the end of their lifetime every now and again, and they're cooled in a cold water pool, and then they're placed in something that looks like a large concrete cylinder. This is called a dry cask storage unit to let the air cool them afterwards. The fuel rods are currently being kept on a pad in dry cask storage units. It's essentially a large plot of asphalt, but it can't accommodate all the spent fuel rods that the plant will eventually generate. So they're building a new pad. The current pad can only accommodate about 30 of these concrete dry cask storage units, but the new pad should be able to have room for what Entergy predicts will be a final number of 61 casks. This is important because this could potentially be the final resting place of all these fuel rods for many, many decades, unless an offsite fuel location is identified.
So Entergy, the owner of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station right now, why this new location? What is it about the new location that offers something that the current location doesn't have?
Sure, yeah. So Entergy wanted to note that they are not building a new pad because the current one was unsafe or in a bad location, though critics like Mary Lampert have noted that the current pad is fairly close to Cape Cod Bay and could be at risk of being flooded during a bad storm or just due to sea level rise over the coming years. Nonetheless, officials have chosen a site to build their new larger pad much higher up and further away from the bay. It's about 75 feet above sea level and 700 feet from shore.
This was announced at a meeting of the advisory panel on the decommissioning. What was the reaction to this new siting for the fuel rods?
A lot of people were pleasantly surprised by the decision. Even Jim Lampert, the husband of Mary Lampert and critic of the plant himself, has said he did not expect to attend the meeting and to hear that that decision. Nonetheless, he made a point that Entergy's decision to place the fuel pad in a safer location was not the result of careful back and forth discussions between the citizens advisory panel, nor is it something that Entergy made out of concern for the town of Plymouth. He says it's basically a cold, hard business decision. They made this because they will be reimbursed by the federal government for the cost of constructing this new pad.
So the federal government reimbursed the full cost of this new construction.
Yes.
All of this is kind of to the side of the fact that there's a company called Holtec that wants to decommission the plant and to eventually, Holtec says, remove these fuel rods entirely off site. Is that right?
Yeah. And so Entergy right now, Holtec's buying of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant has not yet been approved by the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so right now, Entergy is just going as planned with their decommissioning. Holtec has said that it has potential plans to move the fuel off-site, but that site has not been approved by the NRC either. And so the foreseeable future, we will have fuel rods on-site at Pilgrim.
I want to move along here. Kristen Young, a new report out suggests the Cape is on a precipice with its housing situation. And it points to a number of factors and impacts, and then it tries to point towards some solutions. Tell us about this.
Yes. So the Housing Assistance Corps revealed a report on Tuesday that says that a recent expansion of the short-term rental market on Cape Cod has really made the problem of scarcity of year-round rentals even worse. The group also was hoping, though, that they might be able to change the course of this a little bit by encouraging more second homeowners to rent year-round and by pushing for changes in town zoning bylaws that will encourage smaller lot sizes, more in-law apartments and multifamily dwellings. And what they're saying is that if there's any delay on sort of making these changes, it could result in higher prices for goods and services on Cape Cod and the loss of employees and employers here. The report showed that The average rent for a room in a house here was $705 a month. The average studio rent ran close to $1,000 a month. And that renting a three-bedroom home cost over $1,800 a month. And really, even those may seem like high rental prices, that's if prospective tenants can even find a rental. The online short-term and vacation rental market has taken off so much that it's really dried up a lot of what remains of the year-round rental market on Cape Cod. Officials said that Airbnb has been aggressively marketing second homeowners on Cape Cod, and that it lists this area here on the Cape as among the top five seasonal home markets in the country. Some housing officials said that the Cape lost 3,000 year-round housing units in the past 6 years and gained 5,000 seasonal housing units. So that really kind of points to how much of a shift that there's been. Housing advocates are saying that there's really a need for some speedy zoning changes to be made that will increase more accessory dwelling units, or, you know, some people call them in-law apartments, and revise zoning regulations to create high-density village centers and more multifamily dwellings.
I thought it was interesting. They were pointing out that the effects aren't really limited to just the housing stock. There are effects that for people who live here who are looking for services.
Yes. So they're calling this really a sort of a tipping point. They're saying the shortage of housing is beginning to affect the economy, that employers are struggling to find housing for prospective employees, and current employees often leave the Cape because of a lack of workforce housing. So that sort of creates a labor shortage. And then that means that the cost of paying workers higher wages, particularly at entry-level jobs, means higher charges for things like health care and everyday goods.
And tell us a little bit about the program that they're putting in place here to try to address the problem.
So they're trying to incentivize second homeowners to keep those homes as year-round rentals by offering those homeowners a $1,000 signing bonus to make their homes year-round rentals with workforce housing. The program's called Rent 365, and the agency said they'll also help staff prospective landlords with property management advice on tenant selection, on tax and financial information, and that they'll provide lease templates as well.
Sarah Tan, I want to touch on a story from earlier in the week. Governor Baker was in New Bedford to sign a lease agreement with the offshore wind developer Vineyard Wind. It was a big photo opportunity for everyone involved, but it has significance too. Tell us, what does the lease call for?
Sure. So the lease is an agreement that Vineyard Wind will be able to use New Bedford's Marine Commerce Terminal for offshore wind construction for 18 months from 2020 to 2021 for the cost of $6 million a year. In itself, it's more of just a confirmation of what we've seen unfolding since May when the state selected Vineyard Wind to build an 800-megawatt farm off Martha's Vineyard. But officials say that the lease signing is something that sends a symbolic sort of message that Massachusetts is indeed moving forward with this project and that it is taking its commitment to the offshore wind industry in New Bedford seriously.
So the staging is expected to start in 2020 in New Bedford. What's happening with Vineyard Wind between then and now?
Yeah. As you've noted, Vineyard Wind will not be using the terminal until 2020, though they've stated that they'll be starting construction in 2019. That was part of their plan when they announced that they had been selected. So they are actually still on track to do that. Eric Stevens of Vineyard Wind says they'll be focusing on work at Colville's Beach in Barnstable and the onshoring cable in 2019 before they begin staging turbine construction, which would be done in New Bedford.
Can you talk a little bit more about the significance to the city of New Bedford to have Vineyard Wind staging on the site? What does it mean for the city?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think it's kind of like a sigh of relief for a lot of people, like the mayor of New Bedford and for the state. They had built this terminal years ago, kind of in anticipation of the offshore wind industry coming to New Bedford with Cape Wind. And when that didn't happen, I think a lot of people were really concerned about what would happen with this investment that they'd made in the city. And so in a lot of ways, I think many people are very happy that this terminal is finally going to get use. And it has the potential to create, you know, people have said thousands of jobs, at least seasonally, though I think it still remains to be seen if there's a firm number on exactly how many of these jobs are going to extend decades into the process.
Kristen Young in Falmouth last night, a meeting to discuss a proposed road widening. It's gotten a lot of attention and opposition from the community. Cape Cod Times had an article detailing the plan and some of the community response.
Yeah, so the project is a pretty big one. It's a plan to overhaul Route 28 from Palmer Avenue downtown through Davis Straits out to Oxbow Road and T-Ticket. And it calls for road reconstruction, the addition of 5-foot wide bike lanes and a 6-foot wide sidewalks on both sides of the street, along with about 8 feet of grassy buffers that flank the sidewalks. And the accumulation of the work will result in the state essentially using all of its 60-foot wide layout through T-Ticket from the Sandwich Road intersection where the school administration building sits to Oxbow Road. Currently, that roadbed is about 28 feet wide, and it's bordered by narrow sidewalks that are sort of crumbling or overgrown in certain places. And if it was to expand to the amount that was proposed, several property owners would lose lawn and even large trees if the project moved forward in that fashion.
Now, last night, at a meeting with the town and the community, our reporter Brian Morris was there on this. There was a capacity crowd, and they were told that the project is being scaled back somewhat. The project is set to be completed now in 3 sections, with 2 sections running through Falmouth's commercial district and 1 in the residential area of East Falmouth. And project engineers announced at the meeting that this Section 3, that 1 through the residential district, would be delayed based on some feedback from the residents. And there was some relief, I think, from folks there at that meeting that there should be more opportunities to discuss that particular portion of the project going forward. Cape Cod Times, you had spoken with some of the people from that particular section of roadway that were concerned about it and again, expressing real concern about the widening and the taking of the properties there.
Yes, yeah, so James Marshall, who owns a property in that T-Ticket area, said that he's the property's been in his family for generations, that he's lived there since 1983, that he's sort of poured his heart and soul into the home, he said, and that the house is positioned sort of toward the front of the lot because his family had, when the house was built, family members were strawberry growers, and that they used the back of the property to farm. Mm-hmm. And so the house would be sort of a lot closer to the road if this moved forward in the way that it was proposed.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. With us also is Sarah Tan from WCAI. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young, and on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, we've talked about how the town of Chatham is moving to create a task force to look at keeping younger families in town. Now the mandate for that task force appears to be broadening. Tell us about this.
Sure. this past Monday, the Board of Selectmen, who about 3 weeks ago decided to establish that task force you just mentioned. Well, this past week, after hearing a report from a couple board members, they decided that they were going to broaden the scope of the charge of that task force. And instead of just looking at ways to keep young families in town, they decided that they would include trying to encourage a more sustainable year-round population that includes all age groups, not just young families. The board is really taking this situation seriously. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence about both young people leaving town because they just can't afford to stay here, either because housing costs are too high or there aren't the jobs that they need to afford to live here. And that's been sort of changing over the years to not just include young families, but even but older people and also elderly people who find that they can't maintain their homes. Anyway, board chairman Dean Nicastro kind of encapsulated what he said is the concern here, and he believes that the viability of the community is really at stake, and called this the town's number one priority. Now, the town needs to find a way to make a living here year-round more affordable so that, Nicastro said, we don't become, the way he put it was, we don't become a museum of expensive homes. And that's clearly one of the main issues here is housing. Backers of this idea, the task force plan, they've already branded it Chatham 365. And they're kind of looking to enroll 9 to 11 people, both residents and people who work in town, to recommend, to look at the situation and recommend concrete actions to support year-round a more viable year-round community. The likely focus is going to be jobs and housing, as we've talked about in the past, and both affordable housing and what's being referred to recently as attainable housing, which is homes for working people who make too much money to qualify for affordable housing. And a lot of this seems to run parallel to that Housing Assistance Corporation study that was released earlier mm-hmm. this week, which, curiously enough, focused a bit on the Lower Cape, towns like Chatham, which they say will feel the impact of the housing situation sooner and more severely than the rest of the Cape, just because of the seasonality and the lack of year-round housing already that exists. Now, other focuses in Chatham that they've talked about for this task force include something like year-round child care, either subsidized by the government or perhaps even free, to try to as an enticement for year-round families to stay here year-round. And this is something that the town's Economic Development Committee has supported in the past, as have the school department. And there's already been a considerable amount of interest by residents to serve on this task force, and the Board of Selectmen is expected to start interviewing prospective members pretty soon, and with the goal of getting it going really as soon as possible. So we'll be keeping tabs on that and reporting on how they progress.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, the surfing community and others turned out over the weekend for a memorial event honoring the young man killed by a shark last month.
Yes, so over 100 people gathered at Newcomb Beach Saturday morning for a celebration of life for Arthur Medici, the 26-year-old Revere man who died after being bitten by a great white shark on September 15th. The community sort of came together to make this event happen. Pleasant Bay Village Resort in Chatham and a local surfer donated accommodations for Medici's relatives. Stop and Shop contributed baskets of flowers and pastries, and Dunkin' Donuts also provided coffee and donuts for the event, which for a lot of Medici's relatives, this was the first time that they had actually been back to the beach where this happened and you know, saw the place where Medici really told them that he knew the dangers and he still liked to come. He was a passionate surfer and bodyboarder, which is what he was doing on that day. Some of his relatives spoke at the memorial, and including Isaac Rocca, whose sister Emily was actually engaged to Medici, and Rocca was in the water bodyboarding with Medici when he was attacked by the shark. And what he said on the day, he was sort of speaking to Medici. He said, "You've given me a friendship, you've given me a brotherhood, and you taught me how to live life to the fullest." And his aunt Marissa Medici, who was there for the first time that day, said that the ceremony had really helped her, that she hadn't had a lot of time to sort of process what had happened. Mm. She had been busy with arrangements, sending Medici's body back to Brazil, where he's from and where his parents still live, and that this was one of the first times she really got to process things and that it really helped her quite a bit.
The surfers took to the water and formed a giant ring, and as many as, I think, 36 surfers.
Yes, they did. Some were tossing flowers on the water as they went out, and the surfers and paddleboarders went out there. They formed this circle, and they held hands and formed a floating circle to tribute Medici. They also called him sort of part of their community. They said that he was part of their community now and that he always would be. And I think that his family members took solace in that. As I mentioned before, Rocca spoke about how Medici had told him that day that he loved this place, that this was his happy place, and he feels that, you know, when this happened, that he was doing something that he loved.
Meanwhile, as another impact of the shark attack, Orleans officials are offering training on how to stop the loss of blood after a shark attack.
Yes, so there was a Stop the Bleed training session this week that was hosted by the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy at their center on Route 28. And I'm sorry, that was actually last week. And it was attended by various officials who, you know, sort of have roles related to the natural resources here. Orleans Natural Resources Manager Nathan Sears was there. He said he found it surreal, you know, that this has sort of escalated so quickly. That, you know, there were two people who were bitten by sharks this summer, including Medici, and that the presence of so many sharks close to the water and the sightings of so many sharks close to the water has really increased so rapidly in the past few years. To him, he said that he didn't feel the risk was worth the reward, but that there'll always be people who are going to go out there and they're going to surfboard and paddleboard no matter what the risk is. He said for them, it's a way of life. And so this Stop the Bleed training is really a way to address that and to help people who might be in the water and you know, one day find that they need that sort of help. So some of the things that they were saying to do is to really make sure you get the victim to the beach quickly, to cut away the wetsuit and any clothing near the wound to determine the extent of the bleeding and the size of the injury, and that really that first step should be to have someone call 911. Mm-hmm. That the timing is really of the essence here. So these workshops are also going to be continued throughout the fall and possibly over the winter, and they're aiming to train up to 200 people before next summer.
And Orleans, I know they're considering putting trauma kits on the beach, or at least at perhaps Nauset Beach.
Yes. So EMTs already travel these trauma kits in their vehicles, even when they're off duty, I guess. And what they include are latex gloves, gauze, trauma shears, and tourniquets that can be used when needed to stop the bleed, which is really the whole point. But they also said that even if trauma kits aren't available, and as you mentioned, they are going to be making an effort, Orleans is considering having at least one trauma kit available at a kiosk. At Nauset Beach, but people can do this with things like towels or clothing or gauze. They can stuff that into the wound and put direct pressure at the site of the injury to help stop the bleed.
We're going to speak now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, there's a conversation happening about whether the island may need a new middle school. Tell us about this.
There is. The population on Nantucket has been steadily growing over the last decade or two, and the superintendent of schools, Michael Kozort, who will be retiring at the end of the school year, he sees that steadily growing population and a steadily growing student population coupled with a handful of new housing developments that are either in the works or under construction on Nantucket as a good reason for the town to start thinking about, at least, the need for a new middle school. He says enrollment's been increasing about 50 to 100 students a year in recent years, and the existing middle school and high school has been able to handle that increase so far, but it might not be able to into the future. Nantucket recently built what they call a new intermediate school, which is for grades 3 to 5 next to the elementary school to handle some of the influx of the younger students, and Superintendent Kozort is saying the older students in the middle and high school, which are combined in one building right now, there may be a need for a new middle school. Some housing specialists on the island and housing officials are not so sure. They say, at least as far as these new housing developments are concerned, one which would put about 225 apartments and 100 single-family homes on Old South Road are pretty much already spoken for by people who live on the island, that an influx of additional population wouldn't be coming to fill these homes. They'd be filled by people who would be moving from existing housing on the island to that. Kozort, however, says he's not so sure about that, those people who move into these new developments, people from off-island may very well move into the housing that they are leaving. So he wants town officials to at least think about it as he's getting ready to retire and plan for potentially a new middle school on the island. The intermediate school cost about $50 million to build a couple of years ago, so it's a pretty hefty price tag that the taxpayers will have to consider.
Josh, at the Island Hospital, as elsewhere, there are divergent views on Question 1. That's the ballot initiative that proposes nurse staffing ratios. Tell us what you're hearing.
What we're hearing from the hospital in particular is that the hospital officials, doctors in particular, some nurses, although they're split, would like to see a no vote on question one. Because Nantucket is a small hospital, one of the smallest in the state, although it is a part of the partners chain, and we've got some unique circumstances out here, they say, because we're an island. They say that right now, if you have two nurses assigned to one area of the hospital but no patients there, as can happen in the off-season, they can relocate them to another department as long as they have the appropriate training. And question one would not allow that to happen. It would mandate that the nurses stay in those departments. hospital president, Margot Hartman, says many hospitals, smaller hospitals, use that strategy, and it actually benefits the nurses and it gives them an opportunity for growth within their profession. Greg Bird, who's the vice president of patient services at the hospital, also argues that the law would strip the hospital of some more flexibility it's had that's allowed it to handle difficult situations in the past that have to do with potentially staff not getting over from the mainland or not being able to get patients to the mainland if they need it to. If this mandate goes through and the hospital doesn't have the staffing, unfortunately, they would have to turn patients away, there's really no other hospital for them to go to anywhere close, and they'd have the travel restrictions to worry about. Those in favor of it, and which includes some nurses at the hospital, however, say that the hospital is in a position, partners is in a position to hire additional nurses to meet these staffing mandates, that Massachusetts is one of the few states in the country that is projected to have a nursing surplus within the next 15 to 20 years, and those nurses will need a place to work, and it will increase patient care and increase the ability of the nurses and the medical facilities to better care for everyone who comes into the hospital.
Josh, I want to ask you briefly about a story from this week. There was some disruption at the Stop and Shop after a suspicious-looking item was found there.
There was. There was a little bit of breaking news yesterday afternoon. The Mid-Island Stop and Shop was briefly evacuated yesterday after a suspicious object thought to be a possible bomb was reported in the produce section. Everyone, obviously, maybe a little bit more on edge these days, and in recent days after reports of the bombs that have been sent to politicians around the country. So the police took that report. They evacuated the building about 2:25, blocked the intersections around the supermarket, even advised the Boys and Girls Club, which is not too far away, and the buses leaving the Nantucket Public Schools. It was right as schools were letting out to shelter their students in place. They did that for about 15 or 20 minutes until the police determined that the object was actually a cooking pot that was owned by the Stop and Shop that had some construction materials inside that was left in the produce section, apparently. Now, there might have been some work being done, and there were some tools and construction material in that pot, but somebody saw it and thought that it didn't look right, so they reported it. The police did what they would do in this situation, and all's well that ended well. About 15 minutes later, the customers were allowed back in the store, the roads were reopened, and nothing happened that would have been unfortunate there.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Joining us now from the Provincetown Banner is Casey Myers. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve.
Casey, some weeks back we talked about Wellfleet moving to purchase a property along the harbor to protect it for the town. Now it seems there's more to that story with what's being called a secret plan associated with it. And the town hasn't ended up with the property at all. Explain what's happened here.
Yeah, it hasn't even been a month since that last town meeting vote on September 24th when the special town meeting voters agreed narrowly to purchase a derelict waterfront home on 3 Kendrick Avenue for $889,000. This is next to Max Harbor Restaurant and the Harbor Stage in Seraldes, these two buildings. At the time of the purchase, the town's finance committee voted against it unanimously, mostly because they said the town officials and the proponents had no specific plan for the property. And voters, similarly, were not given too much of an idea, definite idea of what the building could be used for. Proponents suggested that it could be a good space for outdoor fuel tanks to service the marina, but nothing really specific. So after the vote, it turned out Mac Hay, who owns Mac's restaurant, purchased the building that closed on October 17th. And right before the purchase, a memo had been leaked that was it was written by the shellfish constable, the beach commissioner, and the harbor master. And these three town officials were discussing pretty specific plans for this area that included making offers on Max Restaurant and the Harbor Stage building. And they said they would like to set the town up to be proactive and create a plan for future use of the waterfront, including the acquisition of those properties. And then they went on very specifically to say they would like a comprehensive wastewater facility and an educational building for shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty – and anyway, this – Mac won't say exactly why he purchased it, but the timing seems to suggest he purchased it after this memo got around. That's why, in our headline we called it a secret plan, because very few people knew about it, including Harry Turkanian, who is the head of the town's Building and Needs Assessment Committee. Now, it gets even a little weirder than this, in that when we talk to the town administrator, Dan Hort, he says, oh, I don't think this is over yet. The town is going, the selectmen, rather, are going to take this up again on November 13th. And he predicts that there will still be a town election scheduled to vote on the override of this to make this purchase. So whether or not, yeah, go ahead.
This would be a purchase that of the building that Mac Hay has already purchased.
Right. So whether or not Mac is talking to the town about buying or about whether or not Mac is trying to, is going to now sell the building to the town is, I guess, the only possibility that we can think of, but who knows? It's very mysterious, to say the least.
Casey, while you're on the line, I want to bring in Kristen Young here to talk about Tim McCarthy. I think there was a lot of disbelief expressed this week as the news spread that Tim McCarthy, who was a well-known figure and activist on the Outer Cape, had died suddenly. Kristen, why don't you start us off here and tell us a little bit about Tim McCarthy for folks who didn't know him.
So as you mentioned, Tim was a prominent Outer Cape activist. He was a filmmaker, an archivist, and a marijuana advocate as well. And his films documented the LGBTQ experiences across cultures and continents. He died, according to his family and friends, over the weekend. The Rhode Island Medical Examiner's Office said he died on Friday in Providence, but didn't really have any details about the cause or circumstances of his death.
Tim was well known to folks. Casey, your paper, too, covering this as well?
Oh, yeah. Tim was everywhere. I mean, we almost called him ubiquitous because he just was literally at every single event, big, small. He was just always there with the same sort of really high level of enthusiasm with his camera. And, yeah, he was just an amazingly high profile and positive figure with a smile on his face. And he was 61 years old. What I found fascinating in researching the story about him was his background before he got to Provincetown, which we estimate to be in the late 1980s. He was actually born the fifth of seven children in Worcester, in the Worcester area. His sister said he was a bad boy growing up. He dropped out of school and earned his GED while he was in the Army. He came out as a gay man at the age of 13 and got beat up a lot and might have been a reason for his behavioral problems. You know, who knows? Anyway, after getting out of the Army, he started working in the computers, as his sister said, and ended up working for the Pentagon. He sold his own computer company in the 80s and when he was diagnosed with AIDS. And at that point, he either moved to New York or to Provincetown, and he's really been in Provincetown for, you know, basically decades. And so it's very, I don't know, to me that's super fascinating to learn his exciting and unusual background. And then just he was here and he was just present every single day with great enthusiasm.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And with us on the phone right now is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, you've got a story about one person who's made quite a difference to islanders as they travel back and forth from the mainland, an iconic presence at the Steamship Authority and with a real feel for people. Tell us who this is.
Yeah, this is Bridget Tobin, better known to people as simply Bridget. As our story mentions, she's reached the status after 44 years with the Steamship Authority of being known by a single name, sort of like Madonna or Cher. And she is retiring after 44 years at the Steamship Authority, most recently in, as the terminal manager in Vineyard Haven and Oak Bluffs. And she was the go-to person for islanders. If you had some family emergency and needed to get off island, get a ferry reservation quickly, she was the person who would be there. And you know, there was quite an outpouring this week as word spread that she was retiring on a Facebook page here. You know, there were tons of comments, and the Steamship Authority had a little gathering for her at the Oak Bluffs terminal, and it was from 9 to noon on a Tuesday morning, and you wouldn't expect that a ton of people could go to something like that, but there was a flood of people, 40 people at a time coming in, offering their well wishes, giving hugs, and writing messages on a board to her. It was just a wonderful thing to see, and, I know she was quite touched by it, the outpouring that day.
George, in another story, two Coast Guard families have been relocated after their housing was shown to have lead contamination.
Yeah, this is quite the story. Two Station Menumcha chiefs and their families have had to move out of some housing at West Chop Lighthouse in Vineyard Haven due to lead contamination, initially discovered when they did some testing on their own, due to some issues with peeling paint and things like that. So they alerted the Coast Guard, and when the tests came back positive, and they've been moved to other housing on the island. And the lighthouse itself is the public isn't being allowed to go there, obviously because of the lead paint. And the Coast Guard says that they're doing all they can for this family, or these families, I should say. The lighthouse, of course, is automated, so it doesn't affect the aid to navigation that the lighthouse provides.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Kristen Young is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, the state Senate race in the Cape and Islands District is heated up. The challenger, John Flores, has made accusations about the incumbent, Julian Sear, that your paper looked at and found that they appear unfounded. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes, so the accusations were made during what was described as a tense debate earlier this month, in which Flores accused Sear of doing the bidding of the insurance industry and endangering the lives of children, especially infants and toddlers, through recent legislation that he sponsored. The claim that Sear was influenced by the insurance industry and accepted money from special interest groups appears to be unfounded. The bill that Sear filed is defended by state officials, lead poisoning experts, and pediatricians as good legislation that offers more protection for children. It's an act. The bill is called an Act Modernizing Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention, and he filed it to reduce the measure of blood lead levels, in children that are required to trigger intervention from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And under the bill, those levels would be decreased. Right now, Massachusetts law identifies a threshold of 25 micrograms per deciliter of lead in a child's blood to prompt mandatory home inspection and lead abatement activity, while a level of 10 to 25 micrograms per deciliter triggers outreach and offers for educational assistance and other assistance from the health department. Sears' bill lowers those thresholds to 10 and 5 micrograms per deciliter, respectively. And that would mean that more children would qualify for intervention programs at lower levels. He said that the lower thresholds are a foot in the door for stronger laws in the future, but that special interests would have killed the bill if levels of concern were identified at levels below 5 micrograms per deciliter.
And how about the accusations that Sear had taken money from some of these special interests?
So Sear's office produced a list of lobbyist campaign donations from firms that might be connected to industries with an interest in the lead poisoning legislation. And there were only four donors that contributed a total of $500 in 2018. And that's according to a document provided to the Times. Meanwhile, asked in the days following the debate if he could identify special interest groups that might have influenced the legislation, Flores referred the Times to Nathaniel Mulcahy, who's a Rockport man whose children have been affected by lead poisoning, and said that Mulcahy was the one who explained to Flores sort of what the problem was with the bill. When we contacted Mulcahy, he couldn't cite specific Sear donors from special interest groups when he was contacted last week.
And Mulcahy's known to media outlets as somebody who's a real advocate on this and really pushing on lead abatement. Is an advocate for trying to lower this as much as possible.
Yes.
I also want to talk about a new study that's being launched to examine the effects of contaminated water. A big part of this study is going to be centered around Hyannis.
Yes, it is. So it's a $2.6 million study that will take place over 5 years, and it's conducted by the Silent Spring Institute. And what it will do is test the blood of dozens of young children from the Hyannis area for health effects from exposure to contaminated drinking water. The group's currently recruiting parents to enroll children ages 4 through 6 in the study. And what it will look at is PFAs, which are fluorinated chemicals that are found in firefighting foams and a wide range of consumer products, including nonstick cookware and stain-repellent fabrics. But the Cape has been a hotbed of PFA contamination in recent years. The chemical has been found in groundwater and soil on and near Joint Base Cape Cod, at Barnstable Municipal Airport, and at the Barnstable County Fire and Rescue Training Academy in Hyannis. Levels of the contaminants triggered temporary public health advisories twice since 2015, and during those advisory periods, pregnant women, nursing mothers, and infants were warned to avoid consuming water from the public supply. The project will collect and analyze blood from 60 children from Hyannis, as well as 60 children from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which officials say have also been affected by drinking water contaminated with PFAs from firefighting foams. So in addition, the study will look at whether children with higher levels of PFAs are more likely to have impaired responses to immunization and whether they have a different biological or inflammatory profile than children with lower PFA levels. The children are eligible to participate if they lived in or attended daycare in Hyannis for at least 1 year prior to May 2016, or if their mothers lived in Hyannis for at least 1 year before May 2016. Previous studies done in Denmark showed that children who were exposed to PFAs have a decreased response to vaccines and raised concerns about other immune effects that are harder to test. PFAs have also been associated with different ill health effects, including lower birth weight, testicular and kidney cancers, liver damage, and preeclampsia. And there were also other things that the Silent Spring Institute was looking at as well. In a separate update, they talked about 150 Cape residents who volunteered to be part of another project that looked at the role of PFAs in drinking water. And that will look at private wells over a five-year period. The goal during the course of the study is to test a total of 250 Cape wells for 20 chemicals, as well as nitrate and boron.
Meanwhile, the state has been working hard to get the word out about the upcoming open enrollment period in the state's Connector health plans, and the Cape has some specific challenges here.
Yes, so officials from the Community Action Committee of Cape Cod and the Islands joined with Massachusetts Health Connector spokesman Jason Lefferts on Tuesday in posting notices that are encouraging uninsured people to sign up for coverage. They posted notices at the Brazilian Grill and Anejo Mexican Bistro in Hyannis, and the goal is really to get more people to sign up for plans that are offered under the Connector, including the subsidized Connector plan, during an open enrollment period that begins on November 1st. So officials are traveling across the state as part of this effort, which is called the Stay Covered Campaign. But they actually have a particular interest in Barnstable County, and that's because the Cape has a higher rate of uninsured people here than the rest of the state. Massachusetts overall does really well. It has the highest rate of insured residents in the nation at 97%. But here on Cape, there are 5.7% of residents who are uninsured, and that's up from 2.5% in 2015. What officials said is that part of the reason for that could be the influx of people moving on and off the Cape. It could also have to do with seasonal employment, with layoffs and sort of the swings here. A lot of people are self-employed and have employment swings that contribute to the problem as well. People who enroll in non-group health plans can call Community Action for a phone consultation to help with the process of signing up, or they can schedule an appointment if they need help navigating the Connector or want additional information. That open enrollment period goes from November 1st to January 23rd, and Community Action will also be sending people to some locations on the Cape, including the Lower Cape Outreach Council, Falmouth Service Center, Falmouth Human Services Department, and the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and Mashpee to sort of help with the process.
I know state officials were on the Vineyard, too, yesterday, beating that same drum, trying to raise awareness for the open enrollment program. Kristen, the chairman of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe has been working to raise awareness nationally about the tribe's predicament with its land in trust suits.
Yes, so Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Council Chairman Cedric Cromwell was in Denver over the week attending a conference, the National Congress of American Indians, where he spoke about recent threats to tribal land. A federal judge had remanded an Obama-era finding from the Interior Department that allowed it to take 321 acres of land into trust on behalf of the tribe. But the federal agency reissued its decision on September 7th and found instead that the Interior Secretary did not have the authority to act as trustee for the tribe because it wasn't under federal jurisdiction in 1934 when the Indian Reorganization Act was signed into law. So the tribe has really been speaking out about this quite a bit. Mm-hmm. In a few weeks, they're planning to go to D.C. to host a second Mashpee Wampanoag Land Sovereignty Walk and Rally. A first walk was actually held in Mashpee on October 6th. And Cromwell's saying that lots of congressional leaders will be at this week's event. And he encouraged tribal nations to contact their congressional leaders and to support proposed legislation that's sponsored by U.S. Rep. William Keating that would reaffirm their land as lawful and establish a statutory safeguard against future challenges to it in federal court. He said they're really trying to build awareness around this and that there is federal law for tribes and Congress responding for enforcing those laws and that we need to ask congressional leaders to do their jobs.
I want to move on here because we're running out of time, and I want to ask you about a couple more stories. One of them is about one of the Cape's signature lighthouses. Truro's Highland Light is undergoing major repairs. Tower itself is going to be closed to the public for a little while. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, so Sunday was actually the last day that residents and visitors could climb up into Highland Light. It's going to be closed for a major renovation project that will last until 2020. The project will make extensive structural and safety repairs that come from years of degradation caused by changes to the tower's ventilation system. The project includes repairs to the masonry, removal and reapplication of exterior coating, replacement of windows and other corroded parts, as well as general safety improvements. And Highland Light will be closed to the public throughout 2019. They will remain a keeper's shop and exhibit room adjacent to the lighthouse will remain open. The project is expected to cost about $1.2 million. And this lighthouse has a long and storied history.
This is fascinating to me that I just learned this, that the lighthouse was commissioned by President George Washington.
Yes, it was in 1797. And it went through several different iterations in 1831 and 1857, from wood to brick. In the 90s, the tower was moved back about 450 feet from an eroding cliff edge. So this lighthouse has gone through a lot of changes already, and it looks like some more are on the way. It suffers from cracks, from corrosion to metal railings, and those problems resulted from too much moisture and insufficient ventilation that kind of happened when it was moved back from that eroding cliff. Part of the tower that facilitated airflow at that time was filled with a cement-like material, which provided stability during the move, but over time promoted moisture.
Kristen Young, you reported a story this week about a Barnstable man charged with conspiring to launder $400 million, and there's a connection perhaps to cryptocurrency here and a pyramid scheme. Tell us what this is all about.
Yeah, so this was kind of a wild story. Mark S. Scott, who owns three homes, two in Barnstable and one in Hyannis, pleaded not guilty September 5th to conspiracy to commit money laundering. The allegations are that he conspired to launder $400 million in proceeds from an alleged international cryptocurrency pyramid scheme known as OneCoin. And we took a look back at his background, and we found that he spent the year before his arrest registering seven new companies in Massachusetts and also registered one foreign company of his to do business here in the state. He also owns about a total of $9 million in waterfront properties on Cape Cod, all of which were bought between 2016 and 2017. Scott's arrest actually appears to be the first in the U.S. related to OneCoin, which was actually founded in 2014 in Bulgaria and still remains operational. Scott also was found to have been an authorized person on at least 13 limited liability companies that filed for organization in Florida, but have since been dissolved by the state for failure to file annual reports. And when we called phone numbers that were kind of hidden inside the names of some of these companies, they all went to an an automated recording for a company that claimed to process inquiries for payments to online companies. And so I asked the operator who picked up at one of these numbers if they accepted payments for OneCoin, and the operator sort of was hesitant. He said, I think so, yes. You really need to locate the transaction number before I can confirm it to you. But yes, we do process transactions for payments like that.
It is a fascinating story. That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you, Steve.
And we heard from Sarah Tan at WCAI. We spoke with Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.